Welcome to Garden People with your host, Jill Sowards of Violet Air Studio. Join us each season as we speak with your favorite garden people, designers, florists, growers, naturalists, chefs, artists, and more about how gardens have shaped their lives and informed their work today, with seasonal tips, expert recommendations, and lots of plants. To learn more, go to our website at violetairstudio.com. You'll find episode information, our seasonal journal, class list, and seed offerings. Everything you need to start your own garden story. My guest is Sel Robertson, author and owner of Forever Green Flower Co., an artisan flower farm in North Norfolk, England, growing garden-gathered blooms for sale to florists and flower lovers. Sel's commitment to sustainability and her steadfast conviction in the power of collective actions to create necessary change make her a persuasive champion of locally grown flowers. As an educator, she manages to twine the beauty of the field to the necessity of spreadsheets, ensuring that growing ventures can become stable businesses. Her new book is out now, a wonderful guide to growing cut flowers that is packed with Sel's grace and wisdom. Sel, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Jill. Thanks for inviting me to come and talk to you today.
And so I wanted to begin by asking you just to describe yourself and your work, where you are and what it is you do.
Well, I run a flower farm, a cut flower farm called Forever Green Flower Company, and that's based in North Norfolk in England. We're just about a mile inland from the North Norfolk coast, and it's a rented piece of land. I don't own any land of my own. And I've been there for, we're about to go into our ninth season of growing on the flower farm.
Well, congratulations. That's wonderful. And what is that distance from the coast? How does that affect your growing?
Well, I guess we're kind of the equivalent of zone, say, 7B or 8A. Mm-hmm. So we're quite temperate and we don't have really long, cold winters. It's rare, to be honest, that we usually get snow. And because we're so close to the sea, we're always a couple of degrees milder in the wintertime than a few miles inland.
Yes.
And a couple of degrees cooler in the summer as well. So it's quite even. The only thing that we do get and what we're getting battered with at the moment is wind. So it's very windy, and any storms that blow in off of the North Sea, yeah, they can be really cold and a bit destructive sometimes as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I wanted to know also about how you came to this work. What was the journey to creating Forever Green Flower Co.?
Well, I guess it wasn't really straightforward.
Rarely is.
The short version is that I trained at Horticultural College as a garden designer, and my husband and I, we lived in London up until 2007 when we decided to move to North Norfolk. And it was once we'd moved, and my children were a little bit younger then, so they're both grown up now or in their early 20s. But whilst they were younger, I just worked locally in a garden centre just for a few years until they were old enough for me to decide to get back to working for myself again, because I like being self-employed really. Mm-hmm. And I decided to start the flower farm. Well, I started looking for land in 2013, found some land to rent, but I guess that was quite a natural transition to go from garden design into cut flower growing. And really, the whole idea of growing the cut flowers came because years before, even before I went to Horticultural College to retrain, I'd worked on a couple of different organic vegetable farms. And it was there, both of those farms, they were growing seasonal produce, but selling locally to their local communities. And that ethic of growing seasonally and selling locally, that's really stuck with me right the way through my life. And so I'd come from veg growing into garden design, and then was looking for another way to be able to work on the land, but working in a way that was creative so that I was growing things. Because with garden design, you're not growing the plants.
Yes.
You're designing gardens, but you're not growing plants. And I just love growing plants. And I'd always had an allotment, so we'd always grown our veg through the years. But gradually, the allotment turned more from vegetables into flowers.
Yeah.
At the same time that I decided that I want to start this flower farm with this ethos of supplying sustainably grown seasonal produce locally, I found that there was this little community of sort of small-scale artisan flower growers, you know, developing across the UK. And then when I looked a little bit further afield, found that the same thing was happening, obviously, in the States and sort of all over the world. And there was this slow flower movement was sort of gathering pace at the time. So it didn't seem like such a crazy idea once I actually right. looked into it a bit more and got going with it.
Right. That's wonderful. And what appealed to you initially about even vegetable growing in the first place?
Well, I'd actually met some people via an environmental protest that I was involved in. And that there was quite a large road system being built close to where my parents live, where they still live in London. And that road actually runs alongside my old high school. So I'd got involved when I was about 16 with this environmental protest. And I actually met people there who opened my eyes to horticulture. Didn't know anything about growing plants beforehand. And via the environmental protest, I met people who were working within the organic food movement as well and the slow food movement. And it was that introduction to growing vegetables has sort of set me on the rest of the path, for the rest of my life. Yeah, you know, I had no, you know, my family aren't green fingered at all. Mm-hmm. So this introduction from, you know, it's quite unconventional, I guess, starting out in environmental protest and then moving into horticulture from that. But I just really found the place that I wanted to be.
Yeah. Well, that makes so much sense. You have such wonderful, both sustainable practices in your work, but also what you share, all the information that you provide. So it makes sense that that was kind of the seed, no pun intended.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it did. It all started with that environmental work. All of the information that I was getting there linked with, you know, sort of, because the road was happening right in front of my school. And I love science, so, you know, I understood all of the scientific, environmental information that I was being given, and it just opened up so much for me, and everything just started to click. Conversations that I had at that point in my life with people, I'd never had before, and it just seemed, you know, and then when I was able to start visiting farms and seeing people growing things, which is something that I'd never come across before, it just clicked that this was real. And that, you know, the first time really putting my hands in the soil, that was, it just, I felt connected.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, and one of the pieces that I love about your work at Forever Green is your reference to garden gathered blooms. And so I wanted to know, it's a very evocative idea. And so I wanted to know what speaks to you about it and what attracted you, what made you want to share that particular way of presenting flowers.
Well, I suppose traditionally, if you go to the florist or to the supermarket to buy your flowers, what you don't get there are flowers that are all gathered together from one place in one season. And I think there's something about seasonal flowers, the way they sit together in a vase, because it feels like they've been gathered from that garden at that one time. They sit together just really well. There's nothing incongruous about the way they work together. And I love that, just that naturalness about flowers in a vase in the home, as if they've been gathered straight from the garden. They're, you know, a moment really of the garden captured in time.
Yes.
And it's that, it's the seasonal connection of that. That's what's really important to me. And that about the garden gathered, you can't go into the garden and gather daffodils at the same time as you can gather roses or dahlias.
Right.
So that's, you know, that you would step out into the garden and gather a selection of blooms that are all in flower at that one time. Yeah, that just really speaks to me.
Yes, absolutely. And we're entering spring now. What does that mean at Forever Green? What are you seeing?
Well, actually, funnily enough, yesterday I was at the flower farm and I was snapping some photographs of the signs of spring that we've got. So, you know, we've got narcissi coming up and starting to bud. All of the tulips have poked up out of the beds, the alliums, irises. They are all, you know, you can see the green growth, and the weather actually has been pretty bad over the past week. And we did have some sort of sleety, snowy sort of showers as well yesterday. But you could really feel it sort of seemed as if there was a little bit of a change in the air. Mm-hmm. And really thinking about the business, because I have to keep lots of records for for my business, so I'm keeping track of what's in flower when. I know that we've got about 6 weeks now until we'll be open for business again for the spring. So yeah. It's just really good to see everything coming to life. And I also saw there are the shoots emerging on the peonies and astrantia. Mm-hmm. So those perennials are all coming. I'm seeing those first signs of spring appearing on the flower farm now. So now I'm feeling in a slight panic that I need to get my finger out and get the beds mulched, get them all prepared so that, because before I know it, the season will have started at the beginning of April and then I'll be chasing my tail.
Yeah,
we'll just be cutting and selling flowers every week and trying to get all the seedlings in the ground for flowers later in the season as well. So another part of what we're doing now, so literally last week we started sowing all of our seeds for the season, and we succession sow lots of our annual varieties. So yeah, we've got a whole program of sowing for the next few months that we need to keep up with to make sure that we've got those flowers ready to cut right through the season.
Right. This reminds me a little bit about your educational offerings. Do you mind sharing now how you transfer this knowledge to other growers?
Well, I run a couple of workshops for growers, but specifically on the business of flower farming. So it's not a sort of this is how you sow your seeds course.
Right.
It's more about the business and the planning side of growing. So I run a beginner's course, which happens actually on location at the flower farm. And I basically, it's a day where I show people all of the practical processes that I use and talk a little bit about the initial planning that you would need to do when you're starting up a flower farming business. And I also run a slightly more advanced course, and that's actually a classroom-based course. And before the pandemic, I did travel to other flower farms to teach groups of growers in other areas of the country. But since COVID, I've had to sort of get my tech head on a little bit, learn how to use Zoom. And I've been running that workshop via Zoom, and it's actually going to stay running on Zoom because that's actually a really easy way for me to share information with people and to reach people who are a little bit further away from where I am and who may not be able to access the course otherwise. So the advanced course goes into a little bit more detail about the business planning, financial planning. We have a whole session. Actually, I'm teaching a session on Monday that's all at spreadsheets. Yep. So all about that particular tool that, you know, helps me keep the records in my business, from everything from financial records to all of the planning and sowing, and then the analysis and the costs of production of all of the varieties that we grow as well.
That's so helpful. I think a lot of people are interested in this work, which is wonderful. And, you know, it's that beauty that brings them there. And it's so helpful to have someone who really knows what they're doing, you know, frame the spreadsheets, because that's not necessarily what brought you there.
No, well, I think that comes from my work as a garden designer.
Yeah.
Which is all about planning. So when I started the business, I did a lot of planning before I even looked at a seed catalogue. And I think in my experience of working with lots of growers over the past few years now, so many people come to this business because they just love growing flowers, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
But they don't necessarily know how to turn that into a business that's actually going to earn them a living. And I think if we're going to be here actually providing that sustainable seasonal product for our customers, businesses have to be financially viable in order for us to be here for the long term.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's wonderful. And can you walk us through some key plants? I think you would have the records for these. Some key plants for each season?
Well, I grow a whole range of different plants on the flower farm. So we grow over 200 different varieties. And we use perennials, woody shrubs, annuals and biennials, and bulb crops, all as part of our mix, so that we can provide a really wide range right through the season for our customers. I suppose my favourite group of plants is actually the perennials.
Mm-hmm.
I love perennials. I think coming from a garden design background as well, you don't tend to use annuals when you're designing gardens. Yeah. So perennials are my favourite group of plants. They're also highly productive, usually. They perform really consistently in extremes of weather. They're more profitable for me to grow on my scale because of the labour required to grow them. There's a little less labour required to grow perennials than there are than is required for annuals, for instance. And I think just some of my favourite flowers are perennials as well.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, we grow, I've just increased actually the number of Astrantia varieties that we've got. So we did have 7, but we're up to 10 different varieties of Astrantia we grow.
Beautiful.
For our customers. So those varieties start to flower from mid-May. With the number of varieties we have now, I've been able to extend that season right through sort of to mid-July.
Yeah.
For Astrantia. So they're just a lovely crop that's really popular that we sell lots of. Yeah. And something that is we sell tons of is apple mint.
Ah, yeah.
Which is so easy to grow, but our customers love it. And that also provides that element of scent.
Yes.
To floral work as well. It's just so important. So yeah, the apple mint is one of the most productive and one of the most profitable crops that we grow, surprisingly.
Yeah, that absolutely. You mentioned scent. That's such a difference from anything outside of local flower options. It's one of the big dividing lines, is to actually have that scent. And something like apple mint probably, I would imagine, would not travel well either because it has those little soft leaves. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's you can't ship mint dry really either.
Right, no, yeah.
So lots of flowers are couriered dry in boxes, but yeah, it's not something really that I'd ever want to ship anywhere. But yeah, as a fresh product that's supplied locally, it's an excellent candidate for that.
That's wonderful. I'm so jealous of your Astrantia. It's a little under our zone. But I think it's one of the ones I have earmarked for like colder spots. I love it. It's such a beautiful flower.
Try it in a little bit of shade. It might.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Particularly afternoon shade, that might work a little bit better.
Yeah, I think that afternoon shade is very, very key. To having anything survive, including myself. I usually in after the afternoon sun. And so I was wondering, again, you didn't have green-fingered parents, but do you have any early memories of gardens or gardening?
Well, so just to explain, my mum grew up on the 12th floor of a tower block.
Yeah.
No gardening there.
Right.
My dad's actually from Guyana in South America.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess whilst they did grow veg and things at his home, so that side of my family, the black side of my family, it's kind of unspoken, but they want to move away from the land.
Yeah.
And that's to do with ancestry and the fact that my father's family were enslaved in an area called Berbice in Guyana. So it's really strange, actually, because I think when I did get into growing, some members of the family were quite vocal with that, you know, what is she doing?
Yeah.
You know, she's moving away from her. She's like ditching her education to go and work on the land. There's this, they didn't understand that at all. So yeah, my parents just not great. They don't sit in the garden. There was nothing in my childhood at home where, you know, we didn't go for walks in the woods. We didn't go to the beach. We did nothing in nature. There was no connection to nature. Which is not a criticism, that's just what life was, you know?
Yes. Yeah.
And that's just not where my parents came from.
Yeah.
But in my very early childhood, we lived in a maisonette. So we lived in the downstairs flat and there was a family in the upstairs flat, George and Peggy, who were an older couple. And I kind of like think of them as my grandparents, really. They just loved us kids. And George had me in the garden all the time with him. So there are pictures of me as a 5-year-old with George in the garden with the watering can, you know. And I do just remember, you know, him putting the seeds in my hand and letting me put seeds in the seed tray and eating tomatoes out of his greenhouse and, you know, the strawberries and that as well. So I did have this connection to the garden with him. And I think he is the one that sowed that very first seed.
Yeah.
But we moved from there when I was about 5. Then, you know, from sort of that age onwards, you know, we had a tiny postage stamp garden in the house that we lived in that was just all concrete and, you know, a little patch of grass for us kids to kick a football on.
Right.
But it was not a garden. And it was like, you know, it was only then at that, in my late teens, when I was introduced to horticulture and growing things again, that, you know, I suddenly thought, oh, yeah, this is me.
Yeah, that sense memory comes back almost.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And what you might consider sort of a private garden space for yourself today, or you blend with the flower company space?
Well, funnily enough, my husband and I, now I met my husband Robert at Horticultural College. Mm-hmm. We both met at Capel Manor College, which is in North London. We were both doing our training there, and that's where we met. And we have always lived in flats. So with just like a tiny courtyard garden, or in rented places where obviously the garden's not your own.
Right.
So, but we've just sold our flat where we had a courtyard garden filled with pots that we carry with us everywhere.
Yeah.
And we've actually just bought a place, and we should be moving to a brand new garden, hopefully by the end of April. So we will finally have a garden that we'll be able to plant some of the trees that we have in pots. We might be able to actually put them in the ground at long last. So
that's great.
Yes. So it's actually quite exciting to have this new garden that we're able to plan together. We've already made lots of plans about what we're going to do with the garden. The house actually needs renovating.
Right. But, like, I don't have time for paint. That's wonderful.
Yes. Obviously, we both love gardens and we both visit gardens all the time. My husband works in gardens all week and I work growing plants, but we've never really had a space that we can really do what we want in. But we, everywhere we've, I mean, we've carried lots of pots with us everywhere, and we love ferns.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got this collection of ferns. Unfortunately, the front garden at this property is north facing.
Great.
So I think we're going to create a little grove of trees to put all of our ferns and hellebores and things in the front.
Wonderful.
The patch there. So yeah, that's quite exciting.
That's great. And so can you tell a few of the trees that are going in, and then anything else that's in the back, maybe the south facing back?
Well, we love birch trees.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a couple of different varieties of birch that we're looking at that we'd like to put in. I've got an Acer, a purple leaved Acer,
mm-hmm.
that I actually purchased at the Chelsea Flower Show sell off day years ago. It's traveled with me for about 12 or 13 years, I think.
Wow.
So yes, we need to get that in the ground at long last. And we have to plant a rowan tree because we love them so much that we named our son Rowan.
Sweet.
So, yeah, we've kind of got a long list of things we'd like to plant, actually, but we're going to have to edit that down quite, because it's not a huge garden.
Always.
And the most important thing that my husband said is top of the list that we've got to do is build the compost area first.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, give it pride of place. That's how it will all work. That's so wonderful. Well, congratulations. That's great. And I guess the other big piece of news, your book is coming out too. Can you tell a little bit about the book and when it will be available?
Yes. So last year was one of the busiest years on the flower farm because mm-hmm. we had so many weddings to catch up with after all the COVID cancellations.
Yes.
But in addition to all of that, yes, I was contacted last March by the editors of Bloom magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And they are bringing out a series of gardening books called the Bloom Gardening Guides. And for each book in the series, it's going to concentrate on a different particular area of horticulture. And they've got a different author for each book. And they invited me to write the Cut Flowers edition.
Great.
So I did.
Yes.
And yes, I had to do that last year. And it's due to be published on the 5th of April this year, which is quite exciting.
Yeah.
And we just announced a couple of weeks ago, we just made the initial announcement about the book. So it's a small book, but it's part of obviously this collection of garden guides. And it just talks about growing seasonal cut flowers for your garden and why you should do it, basically.
Yes. Wonderful. Oh, that's so great. I'm really, really excited. You have, again, such a wonderful way of sharing information. And it's all the things that people need to be kind of working on and with. So I'm really excited about it.
And that's it. There's a little bit of the why in there, as mm-hmm. well as the how to and what to grow.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just talking about sort of the environmental choices that we can make growing, you know, and why we should grow flowers. Because I think lots of people don't realise that perhaps of all the things that you can buy in the supermarket, the flowers have the highest carbon footprint.
Right.
So an out of season flowers that have been flown in are, yes, have a ridiculously high carbon footprint.
Yeah.
But growing your own, it's not just about thinking about perhaps minimizing that particular carbon footprint, but it's also about reconnecting yourself to the seasons. Yeah. And to just a more natural way of enjoying and bringing that outside into the home.
Exactly. Yeah, that's so wonderful. This reminds me of your sustainability series that you were doing. Are there, I mean, there's so many wonderful tips in it, and I think you make it all so achievable, again, sort of the why and the how, which is fantastic. Is there anything that you think of as kind of, I want to say low-hanging fruit or something that think would be helpful sustainability tip that you think would be great to start in your garden, start your practice with?
Well, certainly if you're starting a garden and you're starting to grow plants for yourself, I would always, always, always say, please don't use peat to sow your sow your seeds with or to put up your plants with. Try to find or try to source a peat-free compost to use. Mm-hmm. Peat is a wonderful product, but it should be left in the ground. The soil is the Earth's largest terrestrial store of carbon, and I think peatlands make up something like 42% of soils, and they store a huge percentage of carbon.
Yeah.
So they really need to be left intact in place. The other thing that, you know, when we're thinking about use of peat in horticulture in particular, we are creating wonderful gardens, but that shouldn't be done at the expense of the destruction of another habitat or another ecosystem.
Yeah.
So, yeah, thinking about how we use our resources is key to moving forward sustainably. And definitely no peat. I mean, there's a hard line there, no peat. When I was at Horticultural College, you know, we were trained using peat compost, mm-hmm. and they were telling us all of the issues to do with its use, but still training us to use it.
Yeah.
But I'd made that decision right there and then that actually I'm never going to use this within my practice at all. And so I haven't.
And you have a thriving practice. Yeah. You don't need it. Yeah.
No, absolutely not. And to make your own compost is really important. So all of the green waste in your garden space, if you can set aside a space to actually make your own compost from your own garden waste and even using your own kitchen waste to make your compost, if you've got a wormery or something like that, that's just an excellent way to actually return those resources back to the earth.
Absolutely, yeah. And we have now the state of California mandates all a green bin for every household, part of recycling now, which was, it's amazing how many counties, including my own, didn't do it until the state required it. But for anyone who's concerned that they won't have enough space, you can always, send it out, so to speak, as you're saving it. And that also means that there's a municipal spot that you can take from, at least for us. And it's in our area, it's all free too. So you just have to show you're a resident and you can take from that, the municipal compost.
Oh, now that's really good, isn't it?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We have green waste bins here in the UK as well, collected up, but we have to buy the compost back. So.
Okay, yeah. You have a very strong gardening culture. It's probably a hotter commodity.
Well, actually, when everyone ended up staying home because of COVID, the whole gardening industry did boom and there were shortages of compost.
Yep.
Because everyone was buying.
Yeah.
And they just couldn't make the compost fast enough.
Right. I know. It's like, this is a system. It takes a little bit of time. I thought it was so wonderful and sort of elemental that so many people thought, this is what I want to do right now. I thought it was just sort of, kind of unexpected for a lot of people. And and I think also shows just how much you can do with what you have at home.
Yeah. And actually when you have time, because I think for a lot of people, they don't have time in their lives to think about the garden when they're busy at work and, looking after the family. And just having that time makes you sit and look at things a little bit differently.
Exactly. And then what a sort of cycle it becomes. You spend time and then you observe more in the rest of your life and kind of, that give and take. Yeah. And you mentioned making space for wildlife at Forever Green at the commercial plot, I want to say. But yes. Can you give examples of how you do that in practice?
Yeah. Well, the plot is actually, it's farmed quite intensively, but around the perimeter of the field, there's sort of boundaries between our productive space that's in the centre and the hedge line. Mm-hmm. And we've got areas right around the perimeter that are left to go completely wild for wildlife. So, and there's such a range of plant species that are in that where it's not controlled by me at all, apart from being sort of cut down once a year.
Yeah.
And we leave everything to seed. So there's such a range of plant life there. And the difference actually, when you step into the middle of that, you know, even so on the field, obviously, we've got loads of wildlife, all the, you know, bees and dragonflies and butterflies and all sorts of things. But when you step into the wilder parts, there's so much more going on there as well. Mm-hmm. Because you've got all those different species that are bringing a whole different array of creatures to the field. So that's fantastic. And actually my landlords, Nick and Sherry, who I rent the field from, they've actually got quite a large pond in their garden.
Oh.
So, and again, that brings a whole other set of creatures to the space as well. So we've got newts and so many frogs and toads. So they're great for slug.
Yes.
For slug patrol. So.
Yeah. you have a whole team.
Yes. Yeah. But it was wonderful. One morning last week when I went onto the field, it was quite early. So about sort of 7:15. And as I walked on, a hare sort of bounded across the field. So, and it's just quite unusual to see hares there.
Yeah.
So, and in the whole sort of 9 years that I've been on site, that's not something that I've seen that often.
Yeah.
But we do have a lot of deer. Mm-hmm. And the deer do like to eat my crops.
Yes.
But I kind of have to take a little bit of the view that, you know, we're all part of the one ecosystem and they need to eat too, even though it might be slightly disheartening sometimes. But
that's very generous of you.
I think it would be horribly expensive to try and deer proof the whole field so, and it's not a site that I own, so that's one of the things that I have to work with.
And what is sort of your daily practice there? How often are you out, and kind of what are you, I'm sure it's seasonal, but how often are you visiting the site?
So it is quite seasonal. So this time of year I'm not at the site every day because I tend to run my workshops through the winter season, so I'll be at the site for half the week and perhaps half the week doing workshops or writing or consultations as well. I do one-to-one consultations via Zoom. So, and I've also got a mentoring program, so that runs through the winter season as well. But then as we hit the growing season, so from April right through till Christmas usually, I'm on site every day. At the height of summer, I'll be doing 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. But yeah, through the winter, then that obviously is a lot less. So that balances out a bit. But yeah, I'm on site from between six and seven in the morning. And yeah, usually don't leave till about 7 o'clock in the evening.
And you provide both in season when you're open, you have individual bouquets that can be picked up and then also provide, I want to say, bunched flowers for people to use on their own, correct? Can you tell a little bit more about your services?
Yes, so we sell into a few different income streams. Yes, we offer gift bouquets, so people, or weekly bunches of flowers, and people can come and pick those up directly from the farm. But we also have a delivery service just on a Friday, so we run local deliveries on a Friday. But I also have a subscription service, so lots of people sign up for that, and they can either have flowers on a weekly or fortnightly delivery, and yet lots of our local customers sign up for that service. I also supply a number of different farm shops in our local area. So they have what I call like a market bunch delivered there, and customers can pick up flowers from there. And we sell DIY flowers to brides and wedding couples. So, and again, that's a service for those couples who want to be a little bit more hands-on with their flowers.
Right.
So they can come and collect seasonal flowers from us at the flower farm. And we also, along with that service, they can also order bridal party bouquets and buttonholes if they want that service as well. And it's really great, actually, that so many of our customers now are asking for our flowers because they are sourcing all of the different elements for their wedding within a certain radius of their wedding venue, because yeah. they're looking at the sustainability and the impact and the footprint of their event. So it's so heartening to see that more of that happening now, which is great.
Yeah, well, it's such a big outlay.
Yeah, absolutely. But the biggest part of the business is actually our direct to florist wholesale sales. So, and I supply both wedding florists and so event florists and florists who have high street shops as well.
Oh, great.
So, and that's really the area of the business, to be honest, that I'm most interested in developing.
Yeah. And why is that?
You know, there's most people will buy their flowers via a florist for a wedding or event. So that's a huge market there for growers to tap into. Yeah. And we'd like to get more florists using local seasonal produce. But that means you need more growers growing more of that product at the higher volumes that are required.
Right.
And with that consistency of quality as well for the customers too. And there aren't enough growers who are able to supply into the wholesale market. And that's a huge gap in the market, really, that is there for us to expand into if we can.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. That's wonderful. In your field, you are no dig, no till, depending yes. on your part of the Atlantic. And so I was wondering if you could discuss sort of how you treat your annual beds and your perennial beds through the season.
I used cardboard, obviously, at the outlay on some of the beds, but part of the field we did have to plough initially because of the crops that were on there beforehand, and there was sort of a lot of disruption to the soil, so we did have to sort of plough and level it off before I started laying out the field. But now that the beds are established, I just refresh the mulch every year. But on certain beds, so where I've got shrubs in some beds, for instance, I'll put a layer of cardboard down with compost on top because that helps with the weed suppression on those particular beds.
Got it. And just, yeah, you sort of make a circle kind of around the shrub.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep, that's it. Make a sort of cut the cardboard out a little bit so it fits around the trunk of the shrub.
Yeah.
And then, yep, layer the compost on top. And yeah, that really does give an extra layer of weed suppression because my field is very weedy.
Yeah.
I need to try and keep on top of that. But with my annual beds and my perennial beds, so I do use quite a lot of landscape fabric in my production as well, which I'm not the hugest fan of, but I couldn't manage that whole acre of land without the use of that fabric.
Yeah,
because that keeps down so much of the weed growth there. So if I didn't have that, I'd be paying for the labour to try and keep on top of the weeds. And financially, that's just, it doesn't make good financial sense to be paying people to weed.
Yeah, and it's reusable too, right?
Yes, so I've been using fabric that I bought in my very first year. I'm still using it this year. So it does have a long life. But yes, I test my soil every year to check what amendments we need to be putting on. We're mulching with compost every year. So I make my own compost on site, and I also buy in the council or municipal compost.
Great.
So yeah, we use those. And occasionally I'm able to get hold of some manure from an organic farm that's actually my landlord. He knows the farmer. So occasionally I get a load dropped as well. And that I incorporate into my other compost bays sort of to create a bit of a mix, because that often needs stacking for a little bit longer anyway.
That's great. I was thinking about regenerative farming and how not every farm, not every growing space can have all of the kind of parts to the cycle. So if we kind of expand how we think about what the area of the growing space is, right? It's another farm. It's a cattle farm, that's nearby, right? It's like the cycle expands, and that's sort of how you make that regenerative kind of process work.
Yeah, exactly.
And I was curious, and I think you might be the perfect person to ask this because you have such great records. Can you quantify at all any loss for being an organic, sustainably minded growing operation?
I don't know. I've not thought about quantifying a loss in that way. I think it's a gain because what I do and what I've been doing within my area, obviously there are lots more flower farms starting up now, but for years, I've been the only grower that you could buy a seasonal sustainable product, where every flower you buy in that one bouquet is grown on one farm. So every other florist in the area is, you know, if you buy a bouquet from them, if it's got 20 stems in it, potentially those 20 stems could come from 20 different countries across the world.
Right.
And have no bearing on seasonality at all.
Right.
Whereas the product coming off of my farm has been unique within my area, within the other floral businesses in the area.
Yeah.
And so obviously there's lots more flower farms about now, and we're all doing a similar thing. So I think when I'm marketing my product and telling the customer about the sustainable nature of, you know, the way we grow, the customer's buying into that as much as just buying the bunch of flowers. So I think we're targeting a particular customer who's actually looking for that more anyway. I've got to be honest, I work with lots of florists, and for the most part, the florists are much more concerned with price and quality than they are with any aspect of sustainability. But I think that is starting to change.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're always pushing the sustainability message.
Yes.
You know, and the product is excellent quality. And we're also able to grow different things that they can get at the wholesale market as well.
Right.
So we're marketing those differences, but we're also telling them the other benefits of the product at the same time.
Right, right. That's perfect. Yeah. The changing kind of the market message, but also unavoidably, you know, they can't argue with the fact that you have dahlias and you can't get them shipped anywhere else.
Yeah.
You know, you have your quality is going to be so great and last longer and all of those things.
Yeah. And that's the feedback that we do get from our customers as well. So we know we're doing something right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I always just want to think sort of if someone says, oh, but it's, you know, it's less expensive. We're going to pay for it in a different way. It's going to be expensive for us, you know, not just not in that one-to-one exchange on the flower, right?
And that's it. I think lots of customers, they might consider it with their food, but they've not considered with flowers before that the actual price you pay at the till, you know, if it's low at the point of purchase, then a cost is being paid somewhere else, either in labour or in environmental issues. You know, there's not that connection there at the moment. And that's why I think hopefully by not just selling the flowers, but talking about those sustainability issues, we're getting that message across and people are just thinking more. So they're becoming much more conscious about what they're buying. So, and that's what we want, is we want everyone, including us as business owners as well, for all the purchases we make in our business, we all want to become much more conscious, responsible consumers.
Yeah, exactly. And something I think that almost a corollary in terms of treating the earth responsibly and also the transitioning kind of employment and how businesses are run, something that I keep noticing popping up in certainly every industry with small businesses, but I've seen in growing is how to take time off. And you recently shared about taking some time away from your business to undergo surgery. So it wasn't even time off, you know, in like the vacation sense. But I was wondering if you could share how you manage it from a business standpoint and then also the gain that you had from actually taking some time off.
Well, that was enforced time off.
Right, right.
Definitely. So, and yet that hadn't been planned or scheduled for that time. So in October, I had to have a hysterectomy. And that meant, and I had a full sort of abdominal operation, so which meant 12 weeks off work. And even coming back to work now in January, I've had to take things slowly and not just launch straight back into the physical work and lifting huge sacks of compost like I was before.
Right.
Just have to be aware of my body healing and not overdoing it too quickly. So, yeah, having that time actually was really good, because I don't think I've had... Well, I haven't had 12 weeks off. Well, I can't remember when I ever would have had 12 weeks off in all of my working life. But having that time was really, really beneficial for me, because I did feel very rested. But one of the things I do talk about on my workshop is farmers and burnout, because I don't think I've met one grower who hasn't burnt out at least once. Usually it's most of us every year. And that's just not good for growers or farmers, because again, sustainability of the business is is as much about us being well, both mentally and physically, in order to be able to carry on doing the good work that we're doing. So one of the things actually that I implemented right from the start of my business was that I don't work Sundays.
Mm-hmm.
Now, lots of farmers markets and things like that, they happen on Sundays.
Yeah.
But I made that rule right at the beginning and I stuck to it. So, of course, I might be at home on the laptop, but I don't go to the field.
Yeah.
You know, and now I've got to the point in my business as well where each month I'll have a couple of weekends off.
Great.
So I'm not at work every weekend. I'm not working 6 days a week every single week. And it's so important to set those boundaries and have some of that time. I must admit, last year didn't work out like that. Between, you know, the catching up with all of the COVID weddings and the book and everything else, I didn't have much time off. But I do usually set those boundaries for myself, because it's, you do have to give your head a rest as well, because it's not just the physical work. There is so much planning and scheduling and, you know, dealing with customers and all of those other things that goes on. So you do need to take a step back at times. And it's, you need to kind of book some long weekends into the season as well, to just give yourself a little bit of a break, because it's a 30-week season. And if you're selling cut flowers within those 30 weeks, if you lose a few weeks to a holiday, that's potentially a few weeks of income. So it's quite difficult to take that time off.
Yeah.
But you do need to work out a way that where you actually get your time to sit back and rest.
Yeah. And for solo operators, do you recommend that people hire someone or work kind of a cooperative relationship with another grower?
Well, I'm quite lucky, actually, because I've had an assistant. Her name's Lindsay. She's worked with me for a couple of years. So she was actually due to leave me last September, because she's just started a university course.
Okay.
But when obviously we found out that I was going to have to leave at the end of September for this operation, she stayed on. Okay. And so for the 3 months that I was off work, she was there 1 or 2 days a week. You know, she had to plant nearly 10,000 bulbs on her own in the autumn, and did loads of work starting to clear the field. So just having her there and knowing that I had someone actually that I could rely on to do those jobs that didn't need micromanaging, because, you know, she's been with me a while and she, you know, knows all the farm processes.
Yeah.
That was so helpful to have her there. Cannot thank her enough, because she literally just saved me, you know, because it was sort of quite last minute, you know, that I had this cancellation for this operation spot. So she stayed on, obviously. She's just left me this January.
Okay.
So actually now I'm in the position where I'm going to be taking on someone for a permanent but part-time position on the farm. Okay. So having a member of staff is really, really useful. But having relationships with other growers is really important as well. And I work quite closely with another grower called Julie from Hillcrest Flower Garden. And we both work together to supply our wholesale florist customers. We grow a different range of plants so that we're able to supply them together. But again, when this operation came up, I had weddings booked in for October. And you can't just, you know, these were people who'd already had to cancel their weddings because of COVID.
Right.
So I just, you know, got straight on the phone to Julie and said, this has happened. You know, she knew that at some point I would be having an op anyway. So
right.
She was prepared and she just took on all of the work that I wasn't able to do. So we didn't let any of those customers down.
That's great.
So yeah, building relationships with other growers. So, and you know, having that support network in place is really important as well.
Absolutely. Oh, that's great. And in your, like I said, less administrative but more, you know, designy, flowery side of things, where do you take inspiration from?
Well, plants people, Pete Udolph.
Yes.
He's just, yes, my plants hero, I think.
Yeah.
Just love all of the work I've ever seen him do. Love the way he uses plants and perennials, obviously.
Yes.
And it's really interesting because with his design and the type of planting he does, the structure of those plants through the winter season is such an integral part of his planting design.
Yes.
So, and I love that, you know, and even thinking then for garden design, for planting for the flower farm and thinking about things that you can dry and use to arrange through the winter months. And grasses, to be honest, they're one of my favourite groups of plants. And I just love, even through the winter, dried grasses in a vase. But that just is so evocative of sort of prairie style planting for me as well. So, you know, I love that. to be honest, I love colour. I love texture and I love colour. So, and I love abstract expressionist art.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just that immersion in colour, I think, for me, that just really grabs me. And yeah, I think in colour.
Yes.
If you see what I mean. Yep. I know that's kind of a weird thing to say, but
yeah, numbers have colors for me. It's like, yeah. Synesthesis. Yeah,
I know what you mean. Yeah, yeah. And when I hear music, I see color.
Yes.
So I think, yeah, I just really respond to that, and I just love putting colors together.
Yeah, we at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, it ended in February, but there was Joan Mitchell exhibit and her work. I didn't realize that she had this incredible garden at her home in France. So I'm wondering if it's ever crossing the Atlantic, that show. But
oh, that'd be interesting.
Yeah, it was wonderful how they incorporated that piece into it. And you realize that's where her colors are coming from. So, yeah. And I was curious to know if you included your children in the garden, and if so, how?
Well, if I mention the flower farm, my kids both go, oh, no.
Yeah.
So actually, both of my children have left home now. So I think they might feel that that's an escape. Being called to help out the flower farm. But my daughter, actually, I think when kids are younger, I mean, we always took them to the allotment and did things with them. And even though I think my daughter would have always, you know, not wanted to be doing anything in the garden, now she's got her own place. She loves to grow things. And she's got a whole collection of houseplants. And she is absolutely bee mad. So loves anything to do with bees. So she's actually quite, you know, I guess we've planted those little seeds for her as well.
You did.
And my son actually moved out a month ago. Oh, and he's in a shared house now. He's moved to Norwich. But I used to get him to come. I would pay him to come up and spend a day with me at the flower farm when he had a day off of work. And he'd come and help, you know, spread compost or help me, you know, with a couple of the heavier jobs.
Yeah.
So he would always moan. But he would always come and do it. And he was always really good and always did as he was told. So he was a good worker. But now he's got this little place that he's sharing with these other two musicians there. He wants to do the garden. And he's just said to us, will you come and tell me what to do with the garden?
Sweet.
And I want to put some raised beds in and grow some veg. You know, my husband and I both looked at each other and said, is this our child?
That's amazing.
But, you know, yeah, I guess it's kind of, yeah, you do sort, I suppose you're doing things and you know, we're always, when they were younger, dragging them around gardens and, you know, garden centres and taking them on walks in the woods and that. And yeah, they actually love being out in nature. And they're both, they both love to take photographs.
Mm-hmm.
So they've been out together and, you know, when they're able to meet up, because they live in different cities, but, you know, when they do meet up, they're out with their cameras and they're photographing in nature and photographing flowers
sweet.
And things, you know, sending me stuff. So
good work.
so even if they don't, it doesn't seem like they're into it at the time,
right?
Yeah, it does,
it's there,
it is engaged and something, obviously, and that garden experience that they do fall back on perhaps a little bit later in life.
That's wonderful. It sounds like they really think of the garden life as making a house a home.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's sweet. That's very, very sweet. And is there anything new that you want to try for next year, or you're going to be growing more of that you liked?
Well, I'm expanding my range of grasses that I grow on the farm, particularly perennial grasses.
Lovely.
Because we're tending to get lots more stormy weather in the autumn.
Yeah.
And so that bad weather can trash your dahlias.
Yes.
But fortunately, the grasses are much more resilient. So they stand up to the weather. And also, they're really useful for cutting and drying as well.
Yeah.
So from a business point of view, they're really productive and they're quite a profitable plant for me to grow, in addition to the fact that I just love them.
Yes. Wonderful. Are there any favourites?
Oh, so last year, I put in a whole bed of a particular grass called Penicetum Dark Desire.
Oh, yes.
And so that is really, I love that. Really like it.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
And I've also just put in a bed as well of Chasmanthium latifolium, which is northern sea oats.
Okay, yeah.
So that's already quite widely used in floristry. But yeah, I'm really, really looking forward to harvesting that because I just love the textures of that particular grass.
Wonderful.
It looks fantastic dried.
Yeah, that's a beautiful dried one. And then the last question, which I ask everyone, which is based on your experiences, how do you think we might be able to bring more people into the garden?
Oh, I think about this a lot. As a garden designer, I had a huge privilege of building gardens for two different schools.
Mm-hmm.
And engaging kids at a young age, so mm-hmm. both primary schools, engaging kids at that age, I think is what's going to get them into gardening. And just, I know that it sounds really cheesy, but sow that first seed while they're young. They need to be outside with their hands in the soil growing mm-hmm. plants.
Yeah.
I mean, in the UK, we just don't have enough schools with really, some schools don't have much outside space really, but there are schools don't have gardens and there's no opportunity for kids to learn anything about horticulture in school. When I was at school, I don't think I heard the word horticulture, but it's really difficult if you come from a family where gardening isn't part of your culture, or if you don't have access to outside space, it's really hard to engage in something that there's no connection to.
Right.
But school's somewhere where everyone goes and where everyone should have that opportunity to engage with horticulture in some way. And I just think every school needs a garden.
Yeah.
And every kid needs an opportunity to get their hands in the soil.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just there's so much magic. I mean, even I feel it now. It's this time of year. I'm sowing my seeds from the year. I'm watching over my seed trays, waiting for those first seedlings to pop up. And I feel that thrill of excitement now.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, think if only I knew this sooner, I could have been just enjoying this sooner.
Yes.
And I just wish that, schools need gardens and schools need to have kids growing things.
Yeah.
And doing something real.
Absolutely. I think there's such a difference between visit the, you know, botanical garden on a school trip, but getting to actually do the doing is so key.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, wonderful. Thank you so much for speaking with me, Sal. Very much looking forward to the book and thank you so much for your time. It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Jill.
Thank you so much for listening. Garden People is produced with generous support from our sponsor, Plant Gym. Plant Gym sells unique plants you won't find anywhere else for a garden that reflects your personal style. Find them at www.plantgym.com. As always, thank you for supporting the companies that support this podcast.
If you enjoyed the show, we'd love it if you left a review as it helps other garden people find us.
You'll find links for everything we've discussed in the show notes or on our website. To get early access to our guest list and information about bonus episodes, gardening tips from our guests, and more, sign up for the newsletter at violetearstudio.com.